So how long after you left, after you met Jim, did you get married?
Well, we met in 1949, when he was there in 1949 in Melbourne, and then he went back because his father was very ill, and his father died, and his sister died, and we went over there in, on the 19th of April. No, I think we landed on the 23rd of April. We left Sydney on the 19th and landed on the 23rd of April 1951 in Auckland. And so there's a photo that you've probably seen of Jim and I at Anzac Day with a whole lot of other blokes. It was 2 days after I got there.
You went over there, like, you met him in Melbourne and you corresponded.
Yeah, and I went there because Grace was horrified. She was so shy. She was a really shy person. And she said, I'm going to live in New Zealand where I only know two people. Why don't you and Mum come for a holiday? So we saved up. They went in the February, I think.
Because she'd already paired up with Len.
She was married to Len. Yeah. She'd married Len in 1950, and they went to England because she already had been, had her arrangements made to go to England with Grandma Tilly. Grandma had paid for Grace to go with her to England. And it was Grandma's first time back to England since about 1906, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
And so she wanted Grace to go with her because Grace was her special. And then Grace met Len and they got married. And so Len got a job as a steward on a ship by paying the regular steward to stay in Australia. So he had to pay the steward his wages and go to England, and then somebody else did the same. They arranged for someone else to do the same, to come back again, so the bloke could get back on and go back on with his job. And so Len was, first of all, the steward in the dining room, and there was this family, you know how they have two sittings? And then the first sitting, there was this very wealthy family who had a 13-year-old son who thought that he owned everything. And he, when he sat down at the table, he would order the first thing on the menu. And when Len brought it, he'd look at it. And if he didn't like the look of it, he'd take the plate and he'd knock it onto the floor and say, bring me the next thing. And he went right through the menu, knocking stuff onto the floor and eventually eating the bits and pieces. And the parents took no notice. And Len was furious because not only was this hideous waste and disgusting behaviour by the kid, but he had to clean that up before the second sitting.
Mm.
And they didn't have that much time allowed, you know. And so he said to the parents, this isn't, you know, you've got to stop your son doing this, it's not right, you know. And they said, your job is to serve, serve.
Mm.
And so he was furious, and so the next meal, he had some soups, anyway, a tray of bowls of soup, and he had it like this, and he ran across the room, and as the ship went like that, he tipped it all over this kid. So he was demoted to being a bathroom steward. He wasn't fit enough to be with people. And he had this set of bathrooms that he had to look after, and at 10 o'clock every morning the captain would come round, or the chief purser or somebody, to inspect them to see that they were all clean. And he said, as soon as you clean them, some other bugger would go and use them and they wouldn't be clean again, you know. And so he thought the best thing was to clean them and then lock them all up except one. open them all 10 to 10, so that they were lovely when the chief bloke looked at them. And there was all this unused soap then, so, and they were allowed new soap every day, so he stocked up all the soap in his bag. And and when they got to Aden, he went ashore, and with that soap he was able to swap it for a new pair of trousers. So he got a pair of trousers that he always loved. And so then they got to England, and they were there for a year. and they...
And was Grace on the same boat?
No, different boat. They came back all on the same boat. They both got jobs in England and saved up enough money for the fare home for Lynn. So then when they got back, she said, you know, she wanted us to go. So we went across. So it was in 1951 by the time they came back and went off to England, to New Zealand.
To New Zealand, yeah.
And I went as well. And so at that stage, I just thought, you know, Jim was a really nice bloke. And we were all living in the same house, and I still thought he was a really nice bloke, and gradually it developed that...
So you went over there just for a holiday?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how long were you there?
Oh, I was there for years.
Okay, so a holiday lasted...
We went in the April, and we were married in the August.
And did all your family come over?
No. Oh, no, Christ. People couldn't travel in those days. In those days, if you made... Living in Melbourne... If you made the big trip of your life, you went by train to Sydney for the week.
Yeah. No.
Never entered your head that anyone would fly in an aeroplane.
No.
That was for the people from Toorak and so on. By soon after the August, I don't know how long after, it would have probably been at the end of the year. Everybody else, Jim's mother, Josie, and sister Trudy, went off to England to stay with Josie's sister, who she hadn't seen for 50 years or something. They stayed there for a year. The sister died while they were there. And Mum came back to Melbourne, and Grace and Len came back to Melbourne. So there was just Jim and I there, but by then I had a lot of local friends, you know. So
did you have children then?
No, Roger was born in 1953.
So where was he born?
In New Zealand.
So you went back to New Zealand after?
I stayed in New Zealand.
So you said you came back to Melbourne?
No, Mum did.
Oh, Mum did.
And Grace and Lynn.
Yeah.
We stayed in New Zealand. I was there. And we were there until 1958. We went to Vienna.
And so you're from New Zealand?
From New Zealand.
Yeah. And so you did it on an Australian passport?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then by then I had three kids.
And you hadn't been overseas before that?
No, I'd never been on a plane. And I had to wait behind. Jim had to be there by a certain date. And I said, if these are peace people, they're not going to insist that you leave me here. Because what happened, we'd booked to all go before the baby was born. And the day before we were to fly, I got a telegram from BOAC, the airline, to say they just worked out that I was going to be into the ninth month of pregnancy, and they wouldn't take me. And actually, if they'd known, we'd already got the doctor to put the date back by 2 weeks for that reason. But we would have reached London, where we were going to get off their flight, 8 hours into the ninth month, and they wouldn't take me. So I had to wait till the baby was born.
So did Jim go first?
He went, yeah. He said,
how did he get invited to Vienna? What was behind that?
Well, there's a bloke in Melbourne called Stephen Murray Smith who... became quite well. His daughter Joanna Murray Smith writes the plays. Yeah. And Stephen was very big in the peace movement to start off with. And he'd worked at the World Peace Council when it was in Prague, I think. I'm a bit vague about when and where, but he had worked there. And they contacted him and said they needed a new representative from Australasia, and who could they recommend? And he recommended Jim and said, would we like to go? And at that stage, we were living in a schoolhouse at a place called Maramarua, and most New Zealanders have never heard of Maramarua. It's just a little tiny dot on the map, you know. And
Did you know when you married him that he had this bent, that he was likely to be a world traveller?
At that stage, he was... working at the education department. He'd done his first, you know, after you leave teachers' college over there, you've got to go and work somewhere where you're sent
like an indentureship
for a year,
or something. Yeah.
And then you can work, you can apply where you want to go. But and so he'd worked at a place called Nartia, and then he was, by the time he came to Melbourne to teach at Camberwell Grammar, he'd already done that year in Nartia, and then he went and spent a year in Melbourne and went back and got a job in the education department. And they have two education departments there, one for secondary and one for primary. And he worked in the primary section. And so that's where he was. And he was at university. He'd already got his BA before he ever came to Australia. But he was doing his MA.
Mm.
Is that right?
Masters.
Or was he doing his... No. Oh, I don't know. God. Was he doing his BA still? I know I typed it out, never having typed anything in my life before. And it must have been his... I don't know. Anyway, and so he then got a job, applied for a job to be a teacher. And... yeah, went to, I'm sure Maramarua was his first teaching job. We went and lived in Maramarua, and we were actually living at a place called Kopuka, and there used to be a schoolhouse at Kopuka, and just before, a couple of years before, they'd consolidated all the tiny little schools of the district. They'd put them all into Maramarua and made it a district high school.
Okay.
And so we lived in the Kopuka schoolhouse, and they'd taken away the school building and everything except the house was there. And it was a lovely house, and it was a mile to the nearest house. And we looked down over this valley. It was beautiful. And we had tennis courts, two big tennis courts, and we had the horse paddock and the playground paddock, and a boys' toilet and a girls' toilet up on the hill, but no schoolhouse. And so Jim would drive off to the district high school, and I was there with Roger and Jenny at that stage. They were
so which hospital were they born in?
Roger was born in Auckland, in the Green Lane, the main maternity hospital in Auckland, and Jenny was born in the Queen Vic in Melbourne.
Oh, okay. So you came over...
We'd come back, we had 3 years in, it was 1953 to 56. We lived in Melbourne, in Croydon, and Jim taught at the Croydon District High School. So that was, yeah, I'd forgotten that. And so... from being in the education department, he came and taught in Melbourne, and he was first of all teaching at Thornbury High School, which was an hour and a half's train ride away, and we lived at Croydon in a house, the only house, you couldn't find anywhere to live in those days, and we found this house right on the outskirts. From then on, that was the last suburb of Melbourne in those days. And it was a house that had been a brothel. And so nobody, you know...
Mm, wanted to live there.
So we lived there and...
Is that where he met this Stephen that you were talking about that got him into Vienna?
Yes, yes.
In this 3 years?
Yes, that we were in Melbourne, yeah.
So that's when he joined up with various organisations that led him to the peace movement.
Yeah, and well, of course, Mum had always been... Yeah, Mum helped set up the Australian Peace Committee in Melbourne. And
we've got that. We've done that bit before,
right? And so, yeah. And while he was there, he joined Realist Writers, and that's how he got onto. Stephen was one of the main people Realist Writers, and set up. God, Jesus. to look at what it's called. Overland.
Okay.
Jim was one of the people who set up Overland.
Okay.
And those, that's Overland. From there to there is every issue of Overland except number 32, which nobody's got anymore. It's out of print.
So what was in number 32?
I don't know. It's... No, but they haven't
got it. Nobody's got it.
Overland haven't got it.
So having the complete collection would be a fairly rare thing, wouldn't it?
Probably. We always just subscribed, and then after Jim died, they just kept sending it to me because he'd been one of the people who set it up.
Yeah.
He used to be their New Zealand editor at one stage. So, yeah.
So in this hiatus in Melbourne, that's when he became involved with all these groups, even though there was a background from you and your mother. And
from him. I mean, and from his side as well. His family were just the same in New Zealand. They were just as political.
But then you went back and had this little retreat in
Maramarua. And the reason we went was that we were living in Croydon, and it was the baby boom, you know. Nothing, there was no housing, there was no schooling.
Yeah.
There was, everything was chaos. And he was working at the district high school, and they declared open the Croydon High School. They hadn't yet bought the land, but they'd been there with their surveyors, and the farmer knew they were going to come and ask for his bit of land for the school, and so he was able to ask them the earth because they'd made all the plans, and he knew that. But there wasn't going to be a school there when the year opened, the next year. Jim was supposed to be teaching at the high school, and it didn't exist. And so half the school were going to be dotted around scout halls and churches in Croydon, and the other half were going to be at Lilydale up the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what they were supposed to do at change of period, you know, or hop on their bikes or zoom 10 miles away. It was absolute chaos, and Roger was due to start primary school, and because they didn't have enough schools, they had two schools ran in the one thing by one lot of one school went for mornings and the other school went for afternoons. So he was going to get half a day, half a schooling. And we knew that if we went back to New Zealand, he'd have a full day schooling, and Jim would be able to go to a school where there was actually a building.
Yeah.
And so we went back. And we'd arranged, my brother Stan and his wife had sold their house and were building another place. They owned the block next door and they were building a new house next door to it. And they needed somewhere to live for about 8 weeks. And you couldn't get housing, you know. So we told, at the end of the year, we told the bloke who we were renting from that we were going away for 8 weeks, and we would pay the rent in advance and we'd be back on such and such a date. And so we didn't tell any of the neighbours or anything that we were actually going to leave the country and doing a midnight flit. And Stan and Marge moved in and we disappeared. And so...
And did you pay rent in advance?
Oh, yeah, we'd pay. But Stan... We can't have told Stan that. And he offered the bloke rent and the bloke took it.
Oh, so he got two lots of rent.
Double rent for that 8 weeks. So... I didn't know that for years later. Anyway, so we went off to New Zealand and Jim got the job at Maramarua. And so while we were there...
And were they three idyllic years?
They were very happy.
Yeah.
We actually... Jim was responsible for them building the swimming pool at Maramarua because it was quite inland for New Zealand.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a school pool. Most schools had a pool, but this one didn't. And so he arranged for all the whole community combined to raise enough money to build the pool. And it was fantastic because it was an area that had, in one area, up one side, down the end of the road, the Kaupuka Road we lived on, at the end of it had the Kaupuka coal mine. And massive trucks of coal used to go roaring up and down past our place with to get to the power station. And at the other, in the other direction, there was a sawmill, and the huge trucks with these massive logs used to drive up and down our street to take the stuff there. And most of the area was dairy farming. Some were sheep farming. So the top of the cream of the society was the dairy farmers. Then came the sheep farmers, and they sort of interacted a little bit, but not too much. Then came the people who worked at the sawmill, and nobody up there talked to them. And at the very bottom were the people who worked at the coal joint. And so it was this terribly divided strata society where there was no interaction. And teachers were allowed to talk to anybody, so we could interact with them all. And so, and Jim got them all working together, and they raised the money and they built an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
Wow.
The only school, you know, in those days the school pool was 20 feet long and 10 feet wide, you know. This is, I went back and looked at it just recently and it blew me away. I thought, my God, it's beautiful. I'd never seen it before, you know.
Oh, wow.
And so...
Was it built while you were there?
No.
So it was just...
They were still raising the money. And so they did things like... The sheep farmers would donate some lambs, and they would, because they needed to grow them fat, and so they would, the dairy farmers would take them onto their land, because sheep and cows eat different, they eat the grass in a different way, and so they interacted quite well on the land. And so when the sheep had grown big enough to sale, they'd go off to the sale yards, and the money would go into the swimming pool fund. All sorts of things like that were done, and they, everybody joined in together. It was just beautiful. It was really great how they interacted. And I joined, someone came and persuaded me to join the Country Women's Association. My God, what an experience. And God, it was funny. And you all had to stand up and say something embarrassing that had happened. One day everyone had to say something, they'd some topic. One day it was, tell us something embarrassing that's happened to you in your life. I can't remember what I told them, something that I'd done that was, you know, I was always having embarrassing experiences. And but I can remember them saying, but one time we had to get up and say where we had seen the Queen, because the Queen had visited New Zealand in 1951, I reckon, and then she went to Australia. Now, we came across at the end of 52, and so she'd been in New Zealand. We were in New Zealand when she was in New Zealand, and we were in Melbourne when she was in Melbourne, and we managed to dodge seeing her. We actually had to get out of the way in Melbourne because she was coming down the road, and we really didn't want to be part of this crowd who were all going, And so when it came my turn, they knew I'd been in both places when she was there, and I said I didn't see her at all. And they said, how did you not see her, you know? I felt like saying with a lot of trouble, but I didn't. I just said, I didn't get to see her. But so, it, you know, it was quite odd, because they were from the, they were the dairy farmers' wives, you know.
Yeah.
And they thought they were rather special.
So did you go from that place in New Zealand to Vienna?
Vienna. So we were sitting in our lounge room in Vienna one day, in Kopuka, looking out, and just about 6 feet away from our window was the fence, the wire fence, which was the farm next door. And it was a dairy farm. And all the cows were standing, hanging their head over the fence, looking at us in the living room. And we were trying to work out, should we agree to go or not, because I was due to have a baby, and, you know, we were happy where we were and so on. What should we do? And I said, well, in a month's time, we could be going to the Vienna Opera. instead of looking at these cows. And so we decided to go. And then we found that Jim, I had to stay behind until the baby was born.
And so Jim, did you travel on your own with three babies, children?
Yeah, and I'd never been in a plane before. So what happened was then, it was midwinter, and New Zealand in midwinter is a wet, cold place to be. We had to get out of the schoolhouse, of course, because he'd left
the job. Because Jim had left.
And so the kids and I were at his mother's house, which was a two-bedroom house, and it had her and her daughter living in it. And it was not a happy scene, I tell you. I can't publish anything of this while Trudy's still alive, because she'd be very hurt, and so would Len, actually. But everyone else in the family would understand, particularly the kids. But it was really, really difficult, because Josie had a house that had all sorts of little knick-knacks, pottery people and so on, that had belonged to her grandmother.
So they were treasures.
And I'd say, can I put this up on this shelf while we're here? And she'd say, it goes there. And it was years before I realised that she was just making my life difficult, because she hated me. When Jim said we were going to get married, she ran screaming. She first of all said to me across the room, she said, you've murdered my husband and you murdered my daughter and now you're going to steal my son. She already hated Grace because she'd taken Len off to Melbourne for a while.
How were you responsible for their deaths?
No, she was just off her face, you know. She was off her head with grief at that stage. She was quite mad. And she ran screaming off down the road. And Jim went after her, and I thought, Christ, I wouldn't go. Anyway, she collapsed on somebody's lawn, and he carried her back home. So that was,
you had to stay there without Jim.
Yeah, and it was difficult.
With two babies, yeah. two toddlers. Children.
Yeah, one was nearly five. He turned five the day we left New Zealand, and Jenny was three, and I was a baby. Due to pop any minute. And so I took all the amount of luggage that we were allowed to take with us, which we'd shunted a whole lot off by sea of, you know, the major.
How long
stuff.
Did you think you were going for?
2 years.
That it was a fixed contract?
Yeah, for at least 2 years.
Could and that was for extended. Jim to do this research work with the the World Peace Council?
Yeah. And so, but the stuff that I was taking on the plane, I knew that I was allowed a certain allowance of weight, and I kept taking the case up to the grocer's shop and weighing it on his scales till I got it just right and knew I was going to be all right. And I had 5 pounds, 5 pound one and ninepence or something to take with me. And so
how would you have communicated with Jim at that time, with him being in Vienna? And you,
we wrote letters, that's all, and I sent him a cable when the baby was born.
Oh yeah, yeah,
to tell him it was a son. So that he got a telegram that said son, because he had to pay by the word. And with that fact, that's when I used to send telegrams to the family in Melbourne if something had happened. And you paid by the word.
Yeah.
I always signed it Jim Enery, one word.
Yeah.
And they knew.
Jim and Irene, Jim, yeah.
And that's what I still use now.
So had you previously discussed what you were going to call Stephen?
Yeah. We decided we'd name him after Stephen Murray Smith if it was a boy.
Yeah.
And that his second name, I said, you're supposed to name now after the doctor, and the doctor's name was Andrew, so that'd be nice. Stephen Andrew sounded nice, and we never thought of the fact that his initials would be SAG. But anyway, so I can't remember what we decided for a girl, but anyway, we did. We had names decided, and so he was born, and
that plane trip must have been hideous.
Actually, what I did in the meantime, that 2 weeks was so bad. Roger and Jenny were good kids, and Trudy said to them one day, I watched it happen, she said, "Where do you keep your handkerchief?" And they said, they looked at her blankly, you know, and she said, "You must keep your handkerchief in your left sleeve. Hold up your left hand." And they went, "This is your left hand. Or you must keep your handkerchief in that sleeve." And they put their handkerchief. Afterwards, I took them to us in the next room and I said, "I don't care where you keep your handkerchief as long as you can find it when you need it. But while we're here, try to remember to put it in that sleeve." So it was that sort of atmosphere. And so I went round. Of course, the other thing was in those days you couldn't get a bed in a hospital. As soon as you knew you were pregnant, you booked a bed.
Okay.
Because otherwise you wouldn't get in. And Grace was pregnant at the same time. Janet's a week older than Stephen. And she was booked into a hospital in Auckland. And Len got a job at a place called Waikaremoana. They went off to Waikaremoana and Janet was born in Gisborne Hospital. And so I took her booking at the hospital. And then I didn't have a particular doctor, you see. So I went round all the doctors nearby saying to them, "Would you bring this birth on, please? I can't stand it. I've got to get out of this situation, please." And and they would say, "Get out of my..." And I had no idea that if anything gone wrong, it would be considered an abortion.
Yeah.
And they'd have been up for abortion. And I couldn't understand why the hell they were all so bloody angry about me asking, you know. And eventually I got to one doctor, and I'd explained to them each why I was asking, you know. And I got to this one doctor, and he said, I'll book you in on such and such a day. You go into the hospital and they'll give you preparatory injections and stuff, and the baby will be born that day or the next day. So that's what I did. He was actually born 2 weeks before he should have been.
Okay.
And I had no
obviously
idea.
Obviously no ill effects.
No, I had no idea that the 8th month was a dangerous month to be born in. The 7th month, not so bad, but the 8th month's bad. I knew nothing of any of that, you know. We just didn't know things in those days. And so I went in and they gave me the injections every hour. They'd come and stick another one in my leg and say, walk, get out, walk up and down the corridor. It was just a big house, a big old house in the suburbs. And later on a woman had quads. The Sara quads were very famous in New Zealand. She'd had them naturally. Yeah. That house was given to them to live in afterwards, because they had all these kids.
Mm.
So it was owned by the government. And so I walked up and down, and eventually he was born. But walking up and down, I realised that they didn't have enough beds for the number of women there were. And in the bathroom, there was actually a bed made up in the bath with a woman in it, you know. So anyway, then I had Stephen and was in there for a week or 9 days or something.
And who looked after the older two?
I had to leave them with Josie and Trudy, poor sods. And so then I came back out and I was there for a week with them. And then we went to get on the plane and a friend of theirs drove us to the airport. And I had, you were allowed to take a travelling rug as part of your carry-on stuff in those days. So I had a travelling rug thinking we might need it.
Mm.
And besides, it was another way of carrying a blanket across. And when we got to the airport, one of the cases had a belt around, just an ordinary strap around it. This bloke who'd driven us there, I had no idea. I was busy getting the kids out of the car and the baby and all the rest, you know. He'd taken this travelling rug and folded it up and slid it through the belt hanging on the side of the case and taken it to the counter, and it had gone through. Oh, bloody hell. I said, well, you know, I thought it won't stay there. It'll be lost.
Who was he?
just a bloke who was a friend of the family. He'd never married. He was a bit of a dill. No, he was a nice enough bloke, you know, and he was kind to take me to the airport. But anyway, when I got to the counter, they said, your luggage is overweight. It cost £5 overweight. And I said, I want that rug back. I want that in the... It's gone. We can't get it back, and it's overweight. So it cost me £5. This was to fly to Melbourne, and then I spent 2 weeks in Melbourne with Mum. So I landed in Melbourne with 1 and 9 pence to go across the world. And, you know, when I'd never been on a plane. So when I was in Melbourne and I said to Mum, what am I going to do? You know, here I'm going across the bloody world and I've got 1 and 9 pence. And she said, well, I've got £10 in the bank. I'll get that out and you can take it. And so we went into the city to specially go to a bank where she could draw it out as sterling, because we knew it's no good taking Australian money with me. And they gave me one note, a £10 sterling note. So I get in the plane to head off, and we went to Perth. We had to get off the plane and go and have a shower and have a meal, and then you went to Kuala Lumpur, and there you had to get off and have a shower, and a little lady, an MR, took the baby, and she was dressed, you know, in a white top and a black long skirt, and the kids, and short hair, and the kids thought it was a man, and they said, that man's taking our baby, and so on. And, you know, all these little flights we hopped. It took 3 days to get to Europe, and we spent a night in, I don't know whether it was where it was. It was somewhere on one side of India, and then we went to the other side of India and for the next day. And I know one was Karachi, but I can't remember what the other one was.
You went to Pakistan.
Is that in Pakistan? Well, that's where we went, yeah. And I think we spent the night in Karachi and then flew to Rome and had a night there, a night and a day, and changed planes. That was where I had to get off that plane. And changed planes and went on another plane to Munich and then to Innsbruck and then to Vienna. And
it took you 3 days?
Yeah.
Gosh.
And when I got on, everyone said, when you're in Europe, you'll die. The water will kill you. It's so filthy, you'll die. And so you can't feed it to the children, you know. You have to boil everything. And when we found, when we're there, pussets, this is flowing off the ice. Mm. This is wonderful streams of brilliant water, you know. Anyway... I was never very good at breastfeeding. No one ever taught me how to, and I found later that I'd been holding the baby the wrong way and so on. I was never any good at breastfeeding, and so I took with me a big can of baby milk in case I didn't succeed, and get on the plane, and sure enough, I couldn't feed him, and he was yelling and so on. So I said to the stewardess, can you make up a bottle of milk? Here's the bottle, here's the can. This is what you got to do, do this, blah, 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 blah. So she said, oh, yes. So she took it all off to her little back room and she came back with a bottle of milk and she kept the can up there and for next time. So I fed him this milk and he just went to sleep, you know, drank it and went sound asleep. And... when he woke up the next time, give him another bottle, and he drank that and went sound asleep. And I was just streaming with milk.
Yeah.
And all the clothes I had on were soaked with bloody milk. And it was midwinter, and so, you know, I had heavy clothes on, and God, it was awful. And when we got to Karachi, I decided to try and wash something. I think I washed my pants, underpants, for some reason. And then I thought, well, I'll dry overnight. And, of course, being tropical weather, I'd never been in the tropics before. They didn't bloody dry. So So, oh God, I was so embarrassed about the whole thing, and eventually got to Vienna where it was midsummer. You know, we got to Rome where it was midsummer actually, and I went into the hotel there, and I had this little book that says, "With this book, you will never be at a loss in Italy." It was a phrase book, and so that was all right. I got in a taxi, and because I, you know, had to stay overnight because there wasn't a plane till the next day that going where I wanted, and so. We drove and we drove and we drove, and I thought, this bugger's taken me all over, all around the world to extend the trip, you know. We drove and we drove and we drove, and I thought, what am I going to do? How can I pay him? You know, it's going to cost the earth. So as we pulled up at this hotel, I said to him, "I've only got sterling money." And he said, "Oh, that will be all right." So I handed him the £10 sterling, and he said, "Thank you," and put it away.
Oh.
And I thought, shit. And I was incredibly shy in those days. You wouldn't know that it was the same person.
Yeah.
I was so shy, I couldn't talk to him, couldn't question him about it. I just thought, what the hell am I going to do now? So we go into the hotel, he carried in my bags, and we get into the foyer. And there was the bellhop was standing on the bottom step, and he was in this fancy satin suit, and he looked, you know, very unusual. And he looked very sure of himself, and he kept looking at me and I thought, Jesus Christ, this, and I felt overawed by this, with fear of this bloke. And that was what I was aware of. But over at the desk, there's a woman and a man behind the desk, and this taxi driver, and they were arguing flat out. In Italian, of course. I had no idea what they were saying. And all the time, this bloke's standing looking at me, and I'm thinking, Christ. And so eventually, the taxi driver went, and this bloke took me up to the room. And I never saw him again, so he was no trouble.
Yeah.
And so I'm there in this room and thought, well, we've got to stay here for... Here I am in Rome, and we're going to stay in this room till it's time to get out, and I don't know how the hell I'm going to pay the taxi back to the airport. And then the phone rang. Ooh, so I picked it up and said, hello. And this woman's voice said... Signora Gale? Yes. My name is Michaela Bucci, and I am with the Italian Peace Committee, and I have been asked to look after you. So, can I come and visit you? Yes, please do. So she came round, gorgeous woman. She was about 20 years older than me, I suppose. And we chatted away, and she said, would you like to go and see the town? And I said, well, I'd love to see some of the town. And she said, would you want a taxi or should we walk? I said, we walk. Oh, good, she said. So we walked, and, you know, the kids. And I carried the baby, and off we went. And with my 1 9 pence, I thought, bugger this, I don't know how, it's not enough for a taxi. We bought clothes because we were all dressed in woolen gear. Yeah. And I bought a summer frock for me and...
With 1 9 pence.
And a summer out, you know, frock for Jenny and shorts and a shirt for Roger, for 1 9 pence.
Goodness me.
And I had that frock for years. It was quite a nice frock. And... So while we were, you know, going along, and I told her, I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, because I must have been before I bought the gear that I told her that I don't know what I'm going to do. She said, you shouldn't pay the taxi. The airline pays the taxi. They pay for the hotel, they pay for the taxi. You don't pay for the taxi. And I said, well, I did. I gave him 10p pounds sterling. And he said, oh, my God, Father. Because Jim's wage at that time was 11 pounds must have been a week, 11 pounds a week.
And you'd given 10 to a taxi driver.
week's wages. So she said, no, that be why I spent the money, because she told me that I'd have the taxi driver back. So when we got back to the hotel, she told these people that this man had taken 10 pounds off me, and they turned around and they said to me, "You saw him arguing with us." And I was, well, yeah, I didn't know what she was saying. They'd had this long argument because he said, told them they weren't giving him enough. Oh. So they'd paid him.
And he got your money as well.
Yeah. But I had no idea what was going on. So when I was up there in the room, I had to ask by this stage, I was useless as far as milk went. I'd been 3 days not feeding, you know. And so I needed to get... And when the stewardess gave me the can back, and I took this can and it sort of went like this, I looked inside it and it was a can this round and that high, and it had about that much left in the bottom.
So she'd been really dosing him up with milk.
No wonder he slept. It's a wonder he didn't die. Yeah. You know, wonder it came out of the bottle, you know. Oh, I don't know. It was incredible how much she'd used. She must have used a cupful where it said a spoonful or something.
Gosh.
Anyway, no wonder he slept. And so there was a bell, and this was before Michaela came, that I had to get the milk made. And so I pressed the bell and thought, well, see what happens next. And in came this maid, wanting to know what I wanted, you know. And I said, you know, it all was sign language. I need to have milk made here in the bottle for the baby, and so on. And she said, right. And so I was concerned that the water was going to kill him, you see. It had to be boiled. And so I looked in this book before I rang the bell. I looked in this book for the word boiled. I looked right through it. And then I found boiled cabbage. And quite clearly the word that was cabbage, I can't remember, coal or something. I knew that was the cabbage. And the word that meant boiled was lesso. And so, and I knew that milk was latte. So latte lesso. So I said to her, I'll never forget her face. I gave her all the gear and I said, latte lesso. And she looked at me. So I was off my bloody head completely. These foreigners, you never know what they're going to do next. And I said, lesso, lesso. And she said, you know. And so I said, you know, he was the pot, latte and aqua, you know, and... Lesso, lesso. And she took it all with her eyes sticking out of her head and walked out of the room saying, let me get away from this mad woman, you know. And after a while she came back with a bottle of milk and the can and gave it all back to me, and I thanked her and waited till she got out of the room and then tasted it to see if it tasted, and it tasted all right, so I fed it to the baby. So when we got to Vienna...
What was the thing? Or did you find out later?
I found out later. In Vienna there was this gorgeous Viennese bloke, gorgeous Italian bloke working at the same place. Absolutely gorgeous man. And he was called Vincenzo Buffa. And I said to him... Well, and he spoke so many languages because he'd learned, he was a kid during the war when there were all these different people who were there. And he didn't only know the languages, he knew the slang and the local dialects, you know. And so I said to him one day, Vincenzo, what does latte lesso mean? And he said, doesn't mean anything. And I said, well, what do you know, latte means milk. Yes, he said. And I said, so what does lesso mean? And he said, there's no English word that matches it. And I said, well, what do you do to the cabbage when you make it into, when you have called lesso or whatever it is? And he said, well, you slice it up fine, you put it in a pan and you fry it quickly, and then you put it into a steamer and you steam it. And I'd ask her to fry the milk and put it into a steamer and steam it.
And she did.
You know, a bloody mad woman, and she went and did what you do. But when we got to Vienna, by then he was completely on the bottle, you know. And so people were so shocked. The Viennese couldn't believe that I was feeding this baby out of a bottle.
Yeah.
And they'd, strangers would say, what, you know.